May we turn then to this particular passage, the limits being from 9 to 27 especially. And we see here, as John was also invited to see, he was being shown the bride, the Lamb's wife. What he sees is a city, a great city, the Holy Jerusalem. In the first part of the chapter, there has been the, we might say, a more general appearance of all things new. There was included the briefest mention of the holy city, New Jerusalem, in verse 2. And now John's attention is drawn especially to this city. And as it is seen in more detail, it also serves to undergird and to, if you like, expand a little on the great assurances in those early verses, such as in verse 3, the tabernacle of God is with men. Here, in this passage, further down, we see that the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. In verse 4, we see that there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. And I think in parallel to that, there is the statement later that its gates shall not be shut at all by day. There shall be no night there. The things that are of fear and of danger will all be gone. So it is to this new and this great city that we will turn this evening, as revealed to the church by the one who is the Lamb, the one who prepares this city as his own bride, as spoken of in verse 2, the first part. This is the appearing of that glorious future, which I think the Lord himself was referring to some time before this, back in John's Gospel, where the Lord Jesus said, "I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." It strikes a chord with the very things that we have just read and that we'll go on to look at this evening. Take a look at the introductory paragraphs of this part. There in the first part of the chapter, in verse 2, John had combined two images, and here they are again in the appearing or the summons to come and to see the bride, the Lamb's wife, in verse 9. And then when he does see it, it is as a city, the Holy Jerusalem, the bride and the city. This is the way it is revealed to them and to us. The city, of course, being symbolic all the way through of the place of rule. It was so in ancient culture, and I think that is the way that it is taken up, even as it was in the prophets, so also still in this prophecy in the New Testament. So John is invited and then taken up by one of the great angels, the seven angels, these who had a great task previously in the Revelation, and he's set on the mountain. Some might say that the mountain is a representation of faith, the great and high mountain, that from there you can look upon the future that is assured for believers. And there he is able to look upon this great city, the Holy Jerusalem. This city that he can see in its glory, having the glory of God, the beginning of verse 11. Twice it is said that this city, and again in the first part, the more general statement, but here again in verse 10, it is said that the city is descending out of heaven from God. As always, this is not just, it reminds us that the prophecy is not just a chronological sequence. It is a laying out of vision, things that are happening all around John. And it is just a reminder, I think, that it is restated here, that it is a reminder that this city is always coming from God to men, we might say. That's where it has its source, in God, the God of heaven. So what we must especially realize from here on about this city, again, John has more or less summarized what he's seen, but then he goes into it in more detail, and it's that detail that I would seek to look at with you for a little this evening, what we might learn from it. And as we turn to it, I would outline it in this way. We see, first of all, the city built. We see, too, the city beautiful. And thirdly, the city blessed. The city built, beautiful, and blessed. The city built, then, first of all, and what I mean here is to look at the structure that is indicated to us, the way that it is described. How or to what design is this city built? And I say this because we read first of the wall and then the gates and then the foundations and so on. There is a great high wall. There are 12 gates, each with an angel and each with a name. When you think of the wall, it is great and high. Again, to think back onto what a city was, a wall was essential for security. This is not as in the sense of protecting from danger without in the way that we might expect, because if you go back a little, we've been learning that those who are not in the Book of Life, every single one of them and the great powers that dominate them have all been cast into the lake of fire. But it is symbolic of security. Whether there was, and we see it a little later on, because the gates to the city are never closed. A great wall with gates that are wide open is not going to be a great defense. That's not the point. But it is symbolic. That there is a wall built around this city, I think, is to signify the great security of those who dwell in it. There are the gates, and I'll speak of those in just a moment. The gates each have an angel at them. 12 angels there are gatekeepers. Does that speak of honor? But perhaps it also speaks of the fact that they are guarding. In a sense, reinforcing this whole concept that is touched on at the very end of this chapter, that all that would defile anything that has no place in the city will be kept out. Is that part of their purpose, as well as giving honor to the city? We see, too, the names there are explained to us. There are names on each of the gates, and they are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, in verse 12. And we might well say that this signifies the true fulfillment of Israel's high calling from the very beginning. And I think Zechariah, where we read, demonstrates something of that. Yes, there was to be a partial fulfillment of Zechariah, even at the time of Christ himself. But it's only partial. There is a greater, a fuller fulfillment, this true fulfillment, where, yes, Israel was God's focus, and it will be. But obviously taken and applied in the fullest spiritual way. And it was through Israel that the nations would come to the Lord. Perhaps that's part of the symbolism. The gate is the place of entry. And it is through them that we might come into God's presence. That's what Zechariah was saying. That it would be the ten would take the sleeve of a Jewish man and say, take us to your God. God is with you. And it's something of that, perhaps, that we're reminded of in the naming of these 12 gates. Perhaps we can put it this way, that what is true will endure, and it will appear in the enduring things, the enduring environment that the Lord is making and will fulfill. And Israel's enduring to this place, it will be on the grounds of God's care and God's keeping of his covenant with them. He would bring them to this place. I don't think I need to say very much about 13. There are the distribution, the even distribution of the gates on the different sides of the city. Though it is perhaps a little bit unusual, the order of the points of the compass, and I remark on that just simply from the point of view that it is the same order that you find in Ezekiel 42, when there is also a measurement being taken, almost as there is in this passage. But there is a consistency to the prophecies of the Word of God, and perhaps that is partly why this comes. Whether it is because John himself, he was the one who was recording these things that he saw, whether it was he who knew Ezekiel well and chose rather to record them in this particular order. But I don't think there's a very clear way in which we might understand a particular symbolism of these things. Where we can come back, though, is when you look at the 12 foundations of the wall of the city. I think, again, that's symbolic, and an expert archaeologist of many days past and the environment around there might be inclined to say there's a number of foundations to a city. It's not a very usual way of speaking about the foundation of a city wall, but it needs to be said in this way because the foundations are distinctly related to the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb in verse 14. So here we have the 12 tribes of Israel, and then we have the 12 apostles mentioned in very close conjunction, as has happened on a number of other occasions, and especially you can see that in for example, chapter 7, Israel is named by the tribes, and then also appear immediately after it, those who have suffered for the faith, and they're bearing in mind there the church, those who are living out the gospel of the apostles. It also recalls to my mind the words of Jesus when he speaks of Peter. Peter made his testimony in Matthew 16, when Christ said to him, "On this foundation, well, you are the rock on which I will build my church." And it's often thought that perhaps the best meaning of that is concerned that Jesus is concerned with this apostolic affirmation and confession of faith and the apostolic gospel. And that must be a crucial part of the foundation of the building of Christ's church. It's through that gospel that his people will be built and brought together. So these are some of the symbolisms that we have contained here, and it is very symbolic. It is a vision that John has. In the verse 10, we're told that he was carried away in the spirit, and this is the way he describes a vision. It is something that he has been seeing in a different way. It's not a conventional dream, but nor is it something that would be seen normally in the normal course of life. It is a spiritual appearing of these things, and therefore it has this visionary aspect to it. That is all the more clear when you go on and read more of the building of the city. From verse 15, this angel had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. And the city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth, in verse 16. Not only the length and the breadth, but also the height. They are all equal. The city, when it was measured, was found to be a cube. At 12,000, says here, furlongs, and more literally, it was the word stadia, and it's reckoned that would amount to 1,380 miles from corner to corner. So what it's saying here is that this city reaches from, you might say, from London to Athens, one way, and then the same distance another, at right angles, and so on before you come back again as you go around the sides. But not only that, it reaches so high into the sky. Now it is beyond every human conception, I think. It's immense. It's immense because there's a great number to live in it, but it is also in a cubic form to signify perfection. It is most like the holiest place in the tabernacle and the temple. The old phrase, the Holy of Holies. That too was a cube. This is a cube of 12,000 furlongs, 12,000 stadia. This is a combination of some of these great numbers of the Bible. It is 12, the tribes of Israel and the apostles, but 12 times the cube of 10. That multi-dimension of this perfect number 10. So you can put all of these things together, and it is to point us out, to look and to think upon the holy place. It's to think for us to think upon the place of perfection. It is to think upon the great place that the Lord provides for his people. All of this is together with the repeated testimony that this is the place that God chooses to dwell amongst and with his people. Notice that if you were to take this in a literal way, the height of the city far exceeds the great and high wall. Yes, it is a great and high wall, but there is a measurement of that as well, according to the measure of a man. In other words, that it is not something out of the ordinary, but it is something that man can recognize. The 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man in verse 17. This is the height of the wall. We think it's the height of the wall. It doesn't say precisely. But that's not the point. Once again, there are those perfect numbers, 144, 12 twelves. But it is in a way that is not unknown. It's not on a grand scale. It's not a measurement just so that it can match the height of the city that's described. That's not the point of these things. The meanings are figurative. There is a great wall. It's sufficient for the task. And that's signifying of security. But just so as well, the city is immense because of its great glory and its perfections. And it's all in order to lead us to think on the real essence of the city. This is the way that John saw it, with his eyes, in the spirit. But the essence of the city is to understand these things is to remember that it is the bride of Christ. It is this bride that is it's not a conventional or a mere city. It's the bride of the Lamb that is being prepared for him. In all this great glory, in its magnificence, in its perfection, in its holiness, and also in its beauty. There is then the description of its building, the dimensions, the structure of the city, and to think then on what those facts, as John records them, what they signify. But then he goes on a little further on the construction of its wall, and I turn this to look at it under the heading of the city beautiful. Yes, it is to do with the construction, the structure of it, the building of it, but especially it's driving home the beauty of the city. It's indicated especially by the materials of the wall. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass. This is a combination that appears several times. It was there already in verse 11 in that more general indication of the city. Her light was like a most precious stone, and so on. And again, it appears a little later on. So the wall itself was a glorious thing. How can you describe it? Like pure gold in all its brilliance, like clear glass. Well, pure gold is a metal. Perhaps there is some way of making it clear, but more to the point is the clarity of the glass was a rich, a glorious thing, certainly of the day, where John was, that he chose fit to describe it in this way. But we're not talking about literal explanations. It's the characteristics of jasper and its brightness and as a precious stone. The characteristic of this pure gold. The characteristic of clear glass or crystal. What he was talking about there was to try and mark its glory and its brilliance. I referred to clear glass and crystal. Remember, we're talking about the first century here when John saw it. And it was a very exclusive and valuable commodity. It was not something that you just walk into to Robert Dyer's and pick up. You could not afford it. That kind of what we're so used to as clear glass, it would have been dark, it would have been thick, it would have been something very different. And so to see something, this was John trying to say, well, this is something so brilliant that it's of the highest quality. He's trying to put into words what is practically beyond this expression, and that this combination of things that in themselves don't really seem to work together. It's like that. And we would do that at times ourselves. And not necessarily trying to find a consistency to them, just desperately trying to express the great glory of what he's seen. He's a man, trying to put it into man's words, that men might read it. We can see something, I think. We should be able to see. But it is trying to lift us to see and to think upon the most glorious things that we possibly can and beyond. And so he goes then to the foundations. May I add to this picture? Foundations laid with precious stone, inlaid with precious stones. And the list is there. The list that is found on the high priest's breastplate in Exodus 28. There are slight variations in the names, but they are listed many years apart and in different languages. So the slight differences are not great issues, but it perhaps should take us to think upon that the brilliance of that breastplate and the things that signified and the place that God had this high priest that was to come before him on behalf of his people. Another intriguing aspect of this is that they were numbered. It's not just saying they're there and scattered, but there is actually a number given to each one of them. The first foundation was jasper, and so on. Why might that be? And I'm not sure. One suggestion does come with regard to these stones, that they were not just used on the high priest's breastplate in Israel, but they were also used in pagan astrology. Each one had a meaning. But the striking thing about John's record is that the numbers are completely reversed from the way that they were used in that setting. And perhaps that does mean something. Perhaps it is another way of driving home the point that this is God's way. It's not man's way. God will reverse so much of the way that man tends to think and go about things. We have it all wrong. And perhaps it is an indication that this is the new way. This is the way of greatest glory. There are also the gates in verse 21, the gates and the street of the city. Each gate a pearl, one pearl. Each gate, place of entry for men, for nations, as we find later on, for kings of the earth. It's one pearl. Again, an attempt to describe the sheer magnificence, something beyond our imagining. The street, pure gold. Again, like transparent glass. The great glory, the great treasure of a kind that is never known except in this city. And then, as one writer comments, it's this city that is made. It is a description also of the people of God. It's made for us. It's made for God's people. It is made of God's people. It is God's people. The bride of the Lamb is this city. and it's made for us. But the great thing is that with all its beauty, you and I will not spoil it, because this is what we are being made into also, if we are in the faith. It's a description of the people of God as well as the place for the people of God. And that's a glorious thing. Description that is trying to reach to the heights. And the reality is beyond it, surely. This is the vision of what it will be, described in the words and the concepts of man. And that's what God's people are being made into, prepared for the Lamb. And yet there's more. If all of that isn't enough, if this is no ordinary city, there is more still. Ask you to come with me and to see also the ways in which the city is blessed. The city is built, the city is beautiful, but see too the way the city is blessed. Now I wonder if it has struck you the way that the blessings of this city are further described. Other characteristics of this city are repeatedly given to us in the negative. I wonder if that reminds you of something. How often do we need to describe God in negative terms? Because our terms can't reach, if you like, the positive. We can't conceive of the positive. But we can say something of the negative. He is unchangeable, for example, and so on. And that's the way we need to describe God. And there is something of that perhaps here. The things that we are familiar with, it's saying, no more. Not for this city. This glorious city is further defined for us, chiefly in the negatives. There is no temple in verse 22. There is no sun or moon in verse 23. There are no shut gates in verse 25. There is no night in verse 25. And there is nothing that defiles in verse 27. If you want to know the glory of this place, see that God and the Lamb fill the place of the temple. No temple, they are here instead. They are alive, instead of something built of stone, even precious stones. See that God's own light comes in, God's great glory comes in, and gives the illumination and the light. The Lamb is its light for this city. And there is no longer the need for the sun or the moon to rule by day or by night, as was appointed at creation. This glory isn't variable either. And so there is the absence of night and of darkness. But that lack, the lack of night, the lack of darkness, means full safety, thus allowing the gates to remain open. Perhaps it also suggests no sleep, but in the uninterrupted presence of God. Will that mean that the fullness of His joy will be our continual strength? The gates also are open, which means that there are some people who will come in. This is not in the negative, it is in the positive. There are certain people who will come in. In verses 24 and 26, the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light. And the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Repeated in verse 26, they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And here is the fulfillment of many Old Testament promises of these nations gathering to the one place for the worship of God. As I mentioned a moment ago, they were partly fulfilled even in the time of Jesus. Nations were represented worshiping God in Jerusalem. They were there at the time of Pentecost, as we read. But so much more, they will be gathered now for true worship, true and complete worship. The glory and the honor of the nations is not that these kings will come and take up their residence and keep their glory. It's rather they will bring it, and all that they have will be brought in there to serve the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. It will become His glory as they bow and serve Him. the nations and the kings are great, and men do serve them, but here they come to serve God with all those who would come with him. His name to be above every name. And so these gates are open, as it were, these nations can come in through the gates that they might take part, and they will be the nations of those who are saved to walk in the light of the Lamb in this great city. But though the gates are open, it won't be a free-for-all. It's only those who are saved who will come in. The angels are there, but while those who do serve and who glorify God will freely enter, there is the exclusion of all that will defile or cause an abomination or a lie. And this is also the reversal of much of what has gone on before. There were the beasts who set out an abomination, the image of the first beast. There was the great deception and delusion. There was the lie. And these things are deliberately dealt a blow here, and the reinforcement that they do not belong in this great city of God's people, the bride of Christ. Only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Do take it as we read it with the earlier passages that do tell us that these are the very ones, the ones that defile or cause an abomination or a lie, these are the ones who are cast into the lake of fire. The division is still there. Only those in the Book of Life are preserved for this city. But we may therefore be doubly sure that this city is kept holy to the God of the city. So what I've tried to do this evening is very quickly to clarify a little how the symbols of this city may better be understood. As a whole, this is to be read as a picture of a city that is so glorious as to be well nigh impossible to depict. And it is saying this is what awaits those who are in the Lamb's Book of Life. These are those, as we're told in chapter 14, in verse 12, those who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus. Many of those will suffer for that obedience and faith. Take you back to the letters that introduced this prophecy. And many were in the face, working and living by faith in the face of opposition. They could easily be discouraged. Many have been since and lived in the same way. But this is set before us. It is a great and a glorious hope, a great and glorious promise. This is the place that is to be provided. This is the place that is being prepared. But this is the place that is also the people being prepared to be the dwelling place of God. Not to be discouraged. Look what's in store. It's already revealed. God will not retract. God will not fail on these things. And so all those things that do raise difficulty and fears, all will be gone. This will be a place of complete worship. I believe that there will be much for us to do, but that's not what this passage is talking about. Maybe another time. But if there is, as I think, then all of it will be in this setting of worshipful service and living in such a brilliant city. It is that place of worship that we too might offer glory and honor unto the one who lives amongst his people. But there I must close for this evening and seek God's blessing upon his word amongst us and to us once again. Let us pray together.